From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how Texas got religion.
I mean, to say that it's been one state under God flies in the face of so much of our history.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas has frequently been called the buckle of the Bible Belt, home to mega churches and state house crafted public policy based on so-called traditional Christian values that clash with the constitutional principle of the separation of church and state. But a new book examines the history of religion in Texas and finds the state was founded on the bedrock of keeping religion out of the state house. Joseph L. Locke is the author of One State Under God.
Every day, right, over 5 million Texas school children recite the Texas Pledge, and they pledge to one state under God. This phrase came around in a legislation from 2007. This is part of a long train of religious politics have been targeting public school policies in Texas. Dan Patrick, who would later be lieutenant governor, sponsored the legislation. It was promptly challenged, of course, and when it went through the courts, the Attorney General's office, led by Greg Abbott at the time, argued that, you know, this isn't a violation of the First Amendment. This isn't a violation of this wall of separation between church and state. This is, in fact, a statement of our religious heritage. It is a statement of history, and the Fifth Circuit agreed.
And we find out that it's much more complex than lawmakers laid out to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the very phrase implies a kind of unity and a kind of ahistorical uniformity that simply isn't present. I think this is what I found most interesting about the history here is just how varied it is, how much it differs in, you know, spiritual and religious intensity, how many clashing traditions. I mean, to say that it's been one state under God, it, you know, flies in the face of so much of our history.
When we have these Texas lawmakers, they make this pledge and they require school children to say it. They're thinking about the Texas since basically the arrival of Stephen F. Austin with his arrival and those settlers. And so let's dig into that. How does Stephen F. Austin, and in religious terms, how did his beliefs shape his colony and basically the genesis of Texas?
Yeah, great question. I mean, it's so interesting how much energy has been spent debating the question of whether, you know, the United States was founded as a Christian nation. And yet for all the religious politics of Texas, you don't really see much conversation about the origins of Texas. And I think in part because it's very difficult to frame this as a religious story, right? Mexico prohibits the establishment of Protestant churches and at the same time can't really provide for the Catholic churches. When Anglo colonists comes, it is functionally a spiritual religious vacuum. Colonists can't get baptized. They can't have their marriages consecrated. And Stephen F. Austin, in fact, this doesn't really bother Stephen F. Austin. Anglos are coming to Texas because they want cheap land. The Texas colonists are functionally, they're pilgrims in reverse. They're coming to a place where they're willing to sacrifice their religion. And it becomes pretty commonly understood that to come to Texas is to come to a relatively godless place. You can read it in the letters of colonists who will complain that the Sabbath is not being recognized, that there's no church to attend. And when the Texas Revolution breaks out, it's really not in any way a kind of religious movement. In fact, if anything, it is very much fought on grounds of church-state separation. On the part of Anglos, part of this is a kind of anti-Catholicism that saw the Mexican government and conservatives leagued with the church. But even among Tejano revolutionaries, this was seen as a way to push back against conservatism in Mexico that was seen to be in alliance with the church. And the rhetoric of the revolution was very much about ensuring a kind of separation of church and state, not just the imposition of Mexican, you know, so the despotism, but that despotism that they referred to overwhelmingly talked about priests, talked about religious restrictions, and this idea of religious liberty and church-state separation is everywhere through those early years.
What is a Muldoon Catholic?
Yeah. So this was a very brief little moment in the colonists when these colonists are, begging, send somebody. If we can't have our own, send somebody. And Father Muldoon is sent. Mexico had always struggled to attract Mexican citizens into the colonies. So they're looking everywhere, the Canary Islanders in San Antonio. But Irish immigrants come in heavy numbers since they are Catholic, and Irish priests too. And Father Muldoon comes, and he comes into the colonies. Texas folklorists made much of Father Muldoon. Many of the colonists would refer to themselves as Muldoon Catholics because a lot of these Americans, quite frankly, were very rigidly anti-Catholic and were very suspicious of priests. But when they met Father Muldoon, who didn't really seem to care that much about holding mass, who didn't seem to care that much about the religious duties to which he was entrusted, who was happy to take fees whenever he needed to at marriages or at burials, but otherwise loved drinking, loved dancing, and loved having a good time. And as the story goes, the colonists were more than happy to be Muldoon Catholics.
I love that story because it shows this trend that I think that we're in today, how the people will pick the religion or the religious leaders that will enable their actual very pragmatic needs while providing lip service to their spirituality.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, this is one of the book is generally a synthesis of kind of Texas religious history. So it ranges widely over time and place. And it's not too heavily argumentative, but one of the arguments I really do want to make sure comes through is that, like any good history, religion is historical. While it is grounded in eternal truths, its manifestations on earth are reflections of us. Texas, especially because it came out of that early 19th century environment in which churches were banned, it was a vacuum, and religious traditions had to compete for success. And those that were most successful were the ones that could appeal most directly to the people. That's where the growth would be. And that's what you saw over the course of the 19th century among Anglo-Texans and Black Texans, the strength of Methodists and Baptists and evangelicals in particular.
Texas eventually becomes its own republic. It has written into the Constitution very firm language about the separation of church and state. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, part of this is a function of the 19th century. Part of this is the kind of early evangelical history of many of these Southerners who had migrated to Texas. This is still a function of a kind of Mexican liberalism that is very much opposed to the union of church and state in Mexico. And so when Texas comes together as an independent nation, it is very keen on making sure that religious toleration is going to be at the forefront. It's going to be part of the Declaration of Rights. Very clear that no one is going to be molested on a part of their spiritual beliefs or the religious affinities. And, even has a clause in it that you could find in some other states that ministers or preachers and pastors could not serve in the legislature or in appointed offices. And when the state had these debates, it was like, okay, you can read the journals and see why they inserted this clause. You notice, A, that there's this real tangible fear that if church and state are united, it would be dangerous. It's dangerous to civil liberty. In their minds, they have ideas of the Puritans, they have ideas of the Spanish Inquisition, of witch burnings, and they're very fearful of this. But what you also notice too is that evangelicals themselves are championing this, right? The Baptist Church was one of the foremost champions of church-state separation in early America, and you find them cheering this on. They themselves had been dissenters in places like New England and had seen what happened when you had an established church. And so somebody like R.E.B. Baylor, who was there in 1845 when Texas becomes a state, argues for the continuation of these policies, knowing or believing that it's good not just for state, it's good for church, right? The separation serves both. Religion is about the next world, government is about this one, and never the two shall meet.
Well, then that separation begins to break down over the years, particularly as when Texas becomes a state and becomes a slave-holding state. We see a growth of organized religion that provides an excuse structure for justification of enslavement.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think this is perhaps the clearest example of how a religion is historical, how it reflects us. It's easy to be very cynical about this and frame this as an excuse, but I mean, functionally, you know, they're not doing this cynically necessarily. I mean, you know, in a historical sense, yes, but they feel very forth. They are not having spiritual doubts. They're not hatching this in some kind of theological plot. But the way that these churches operate is such that for white Texans, they very much believe that what they are doing is a godly spiritual enterprise. You've lost that kind of early 19th century kind of potential hang up, even though, you know, you have white slaveholders and all that. By the 19th century in Texas, these people are white Texans are entirely pro-slavery. And they're pro-slavery in part because they're being told in church that it is right. No one is hiding this. Everybody, this is consensus. This is not controversial. This is widely believed that true faith demands this. In fact, when Texas does secede from the Union and puts forward a new declaration of the secession, what would have been our Declaration of Independence basically says that this is sanctioned by the Almighty, that white and black were separated, black people were set apart by God to be enslaved, and that this is right and holy. And in fact, what's interesting at the time is that if you would have told many Texans that religion was being politicized, that there was something called a Bible Belt, they all would have thought we were talking about the North, and especially New England and the Midwest, where abolition was being fueled in part by Northern churches. For Texans, they were complaining that all these Northerners were bringing their religion into politics, and so they were returning to scripture for justification of slavery. And then, of course, on the flip side, Black Texans were very confident that this was all very false. Black Texans had been evangelized over the preceding decades. Protestant faith had taken hold among Texas's enslaved population, which was roughly one-third of the entire population in Texas. What's interesting is they're still blending some African traditions. Many of these, you know, individuals by the 1850s very well could have been born in Africa, or their parents were African. And so they are kind of blending these indigenous faiths from West Africa with American Christianity. But they are very conscious that the Christianity they are being sold, one of submission, one of worldly peace and then eternal reward, was to them quite cynical. And they knew, in fact, that they looked to stories of deliverance. And while enslaved preachers did exist, they would preach one gospel in front of white Texans, and then, of course, a different gospel among black Texans, one that promised deliverance, one promised an eventual end to enslavement.
Skipping ahead to Reconstruction and then past that, religion, does it continue to grow as a bind, as a way to create a Texas society?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think this is really the key turning point in the story. I think, you know, we see Texas today and we see the giant crosses and the billboards and the mega churches, and we assume that that's just a kind of native Texas phenomenon. The reality is Texas grew from fairly irreligious soil. Throughout much of the 19th century, Texas was among the lowest states when it came to religious adherence or to church membership. And it was only really in this kind of late 19th, early 20th century period where you really see jumps in church growth and membership drives. Part of this is urbanization. Part of this is this new massive influx of wealth through oil, ranching, railroads. And some of this, too, where my entry point into a lot of this history was issues like prohibition, really the first true culture war fight in Texas that absolutely dominated public discussion for several decades. This question of whether or not alcohol should be banned, a saloon should be closed. And what religious leaders noticed was how passionate this made people, how it could consume headlines. And it was tricky because it was interjecting religion into politics really for the first most overt time in Texas history. But what they noticed was how much energy it generated. And a lot of the most important Protestant leaders in Texas come out of the Prohibition Crusade. They build their kind of leadership profiles through these political battles, and that's what propels them forwards. That's what allows them to build the first true mega churches. That's what allows them to frame fundamentalist as this kind of cultural barrier between what's seen as a kind of American modernism. And that's really what begins to create this religious politics that we begin to see in the 20th century.
In 1913, Congressman Morris Shepherd, He is elected to the U.S. Senate. He is later known to be the father of national prohibition, and he is a firm believer that America was and should always be a Christian nation. But he was a prohibitionist, and so he comes from a religious grounding and leads the nation to what we now recognize as this massive mistake.
Yeah, Morris Shepherd does as much as anyone to push for national prohibition, and will continue to push for it after it's enacted, and will continue to fight repeal. Morris Shepherd is a really interesting character. Not much has been written about him. He's a Christian nationalist, and he's one of the first real Christian nationalists in Texas to assume national office and build a large profile. But what's interesting about Morris Shepherd is he is coming on the wave of this kind of evangelical insurgency over the past several decades. He represents their cause and he pushes it effectively through Congress. But his form of Christian nationalism is very different from what's going to come even a decade later. He's very much a product of the progressive movement. After pushing for prohibition, he co-sponsors really what is the first modern piece of American welfare legislation, the Shepherd Towner Act, that provides direct funding for mothers and for young children. And his version is functionally not going to survive. And it's very quickly overtaken by this other strand of the prohibition movement that we more closely associate with fundamentalists like First Baptist Church of Fort Worth pastor J. Frank Norris, who takes a much more aggressive approach, a much more culture war approach, that an issue like prohibition is far less about enacting any kind of social justice or performing a social good, and much more about asserting a kind of particular religious culture over immigrants, over Black Texans, over Mexican Texans, and begins to push issues like evolution, anti-dancing causes, Sunday closing laws, and then later segregation and anti-communism.
Texas was at the forefront of trying to deny evolution in 1923. The state House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill declaring that it will be unlawful to teach the theory of evolution as fact, or to use any textbook that advances the idea that man was evolved from the lower life. It never became law, but it was certainly a stand. This is Texas passing laws in favor of religion and opposed to science. And this is a tradition that continues today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, the 1920s is this extremely tense time in Texas history. I mean, we know this nationally is, you know, the Jazz Age, the Roaring 20s, and it has this kind of fun veneer to it, but it also has this very reactionary half to it. This is the time when the second Ku Klux Klan erupts across the nation, and especially in Texas. The Klan runs on this kind of repressive anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Black program, but it's also very fundamentally a kind of religious nationalist movement to restore Protestant Christianity. They felt that it's been under assault by immigrants, under assault by Catholics and free thinkers and atheists. And there's this push throughout Texas politics. You get politicians like Senator Earl Mayfield that was fundamentally chosen by a kind of Klan nominating caucus, or Felix Robertson, who runs for governor. And so you see this religious politics enter into Texas life. Evolution is certainly a part of that. Evolution is seen, even though the concept had been around for some time, it is now one of these levers that especially fundamentalist Texans can use to assert their identity, assert their group, assert their beliefs over the public. And they're beginning to realize that, yes, education is where you go when you want to target this. Ensure that atheists can't be on the faculty of the University of Texas. Make sure that Texas textbooks are preaching the right gospel. And this works at all levels. Somebody like J. Frank Norris, who is among the most important fundamentalists nationally, goes against Baylor and is rooting through faculty profiles and lectures and publications, making sure there is no hint of theological heterodoxy among even the religious. And there is this kind of purification that is happening as religious warfare continues to push right, and whoever is pushing hardest is inevitably going to win the biggest headlines, grow the biggest church, and get the most fundraising numbers.
We get to the era of mass communication, radio. It doesn't matter how poor a family is, they basically can have a radio. That's going to be their form of entertainment in the center of their leisure hours. What kind of religion are they getting from their radio?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, what the radio opens up, you know, first, before you get this big conglomeration of the big media corporations, you know, radio is very local. And so you can hear a kind of local pastor that maybe is on the other side of town that you might not have otherwise have access to. And then as you move through the 20s and this kind of culture war idea takes off, you begin to get access to a greater number of regional national voices. Somebody, say, like Papio Daniel, who is essentially a flour baron, a flour that you use wheat to make bread, who is able to put on this kind of entertaining brand of faith that can be infused with popular music. This is when you really get the rise of kind of like a religious music, a gospel music that takes off. You see somebody like the Carter family, who comes to, as you know, comes to San Antonio, goes to those Border Blaster radio stations and has these national audiences. And so you get somebody who can kind of like frame what had been seen as a very kind of mean-spirited, aggressive, militant faith, and can be repackaged. The Carter family is certainly not doing that. They're a kind of more traditional gospel group. But somebody like Papio Daniel can have these kind of simple truths of, you know, I'm just a simple country flower salesman, but I believe in the Ten Commandments. Somebody like J. Frank Dobie, this old Texas arch folklorist, said, you know, somebody like Papio Daniel marked the time where you no longer had to care about government or have any deep understanding of politics. You just mentioned the Ten Commandments and you're good to go. But it also will open up for a more aggressive form of a kind of fundamentalist gospel. As you get into the 20s and especially the 1930s, J. Frank Norris builds a kind of national profile through radio sermons. Somebody like W.A. Criswell, who will later pastor First Baptist Church in Dallas and be perhaps the most important kind of Baptist pastor in Texas, will remember growing up in a rural part of Texas or Oklahoma and hearing Norris on the radio. Somebody like John Rice, this very aggressive fundamentalist, will have access to the radio. And so even if your local church might not be preaching that message because it has to appeal to your community, now you can find a kind of harder-edged Christianity. So you see both of those, I think, this kind of softer-edged, pop-facing religious gospel, but also this harder-edged fundamentalist gospel.
Just want to mention that Papio Daniel, William Lee O'Daniel, who went from being the flower salesman on the radio with a hillbilly band to becoming governor of Texas and using his religious sermons as a way to get there, talking about using the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule for the basis of a governing Texas. And then he went on to be a U.S. senator. Let's talk about, though, how Texas has also been has a long tradition of free thought, anti-religion.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think this is always one of the most surprising aspects of Texas history for me, that you see this as this part of the Bible Belt. You assume faith is fairly ubiquitous. And the reality is this was not always the case. And in fact, you see this counter tradition. Some of this is brought in. It's imported. German immigrants, and especially fleeing the revolutions of the 19th century, come. They bring a form of free thought. Comfort, Texas, actually, you know, they ban churches up through, I think, the 20th century because they come out of this tradition of free thought. Robert Ingersoll, the great American agnostic, who was quite well known in the 19th century, he comes in on a massive tour, and Texans come out by the hundreds and the thousands to listen to him. One town is even renamed Ingersoll in his honor. But there are these homegrown versions of this as well. You see this with sometimes these are kind of fallen Methodist and Baptist. Sometimes it's quite kind of like they're reading Macaulay's histories or something like that, or they're reading Thomas Paine and they have this kind of awakening. And they begin forming these free thinking communities. Somebody like J.D. Shaw in Dallas in the late 19th century, several observers say that when they go to his free thought meetings, they see more people there than at any other church service in the city. Some of this is being framed also in a kind of commitment to separation of church and state. William Cowper Brand, this very caustic journalist who's based in Waco, who in many ways is a forerunner for somebody like H.L. Mencken, who was famous as this kind of liberal satirist in the 1920s, and who in fact comes up with the label Bible Belt. Roan Cowper Brown in Waco is just flaying these Baptists, has a publication, The Iconoclast, that whose subscription is probably in the hundreds of thousands. And of course, he's eventually shot and killed on a Waco street by a Baptist, as if this story couldn't be, even more Texas. But what his popularity and the nerve he triggered is a testament, I think, to this alternate tradition that persists up through the 20th century. Madeline Murray O'Hara, the most hated woman in America, relocates to Austin and is host to probably the most important national atheist organization through the 20th century. Like William Cowper Brown, in some way, who was killed by a Baptist. I mean, it's easy to read these as a kind of metaphor for these traditions that ultimately are trampled over and run over. But in some ways, atheism, agnosticism, and then nothing really in particular are still actually booming in Texas. And in fact, if you want to talk about the fastest growing groups in Texas in the 21st century, it's these groups. It's not evangelical Texans. It is the so-called nuns.
What do you mean, the so-called nuns?
Yeah, this is a term that sociologists use and you see more and more now. It's those who, when you ask on a poll, what's your religion? And people say, okay, I'm Protestant, I'm a Catholic, or they might, I'm Baptist, I'm a Methodist. And then a growing number, starting, maybe 20 years ago or so, increasingly began saying, oh, I'm nothing in particular. And we refer to these as the nuns, right? Not the kind of religious nuns. And in Texas today, their numbers have essentially doubled over the last 15 years. It's fundamentally a generational change. You see it especially with millennials and Generation Z. And that group is a mixture. Maybe about a third of them are explicitly atheist and agnostic, and about two-thirds of them simply say nothing in particular. They may still even pray, they may still consider them spiritual, but they have no real allegiance to any definable tradition. And taken all together, that's roughly a quarter of Texans today.
So does that say anything in particular about the future of Texas with these mega churches and these superstar televangelists?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think historians don't always have a great track record of plotting out how the past is going to become the future. And so I think it's extremely hard to say. I mean, certainly we know there have been demographic prognostications about the kind of fate of Texas, especially in regards to politics, that have fallen flat on their face. I mean, the demographic changes seem to suggest that the kind of ruling religious politics of Texas today, frankly, should not exist. White evangelical Texans, those who identify them clearly as such, is really like 1 in 7, 1 in 6 of the population. Protestant Christianity has been declining in numbers for years now. Today, less than half of Texans are even Protestant. And so you would think maybe these religious politics are spent. The demographics simply won't support them. But what we notice today is, of course, is that's very much not the case. If anything, you see this religious politics being intensified. The reasons for that are numerous. Some of that absolutely is the money that's been pouring in, especially over the last few years. Although this is a longer history, you have ranchers funding Baptist organizations. This is a big tradition. In the mid-century, the oil barons who were also propping up, Billy Graham and a lot of the Texas religious establishment. But yes, the billionaire money has certainly been pouring in. There are networks built up. We live in a polarized time, gerrymandering, and which rewards, pushing further and further and further to the extremes. And so the question is, how long is this sustainable? And I don't think history gives us a clear answer. You could certainly, numbers, demographics, this is not necessarily destiny. But yeah, the demographics are transforming rapidly and really quick. Yeah, I mean, dramatically and quickly.
Joseph L. Locke is the author of One State Under God. It's published by the University of Texas Press. And that's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can download and subscribe to Texas Matters wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.